Making up data the old hard way. Fudging the numbers day by day. Ignoring the snow and the cold in a downward line. Hide the decline. Michael Mann.
Hello, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, podcasting to you from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And welcome to a conversation I had a few days ago with the climatologist Dr. Tim Ball. First, however, I do need to say something about the problem that we've been having with our podcast feeds. Now, my apologies to any of you who've been subscribed to those RSS feeds on the Mind Renewed website. As far as I know, iTunes hasn't been affected, but a few days ago, both the high-quality feed and the low-quality feed stopped allowing people to subscribe, and if you looked in your browser for an update to the feed, you got the following message: this feed no longer exists. Which wasn't actually true, the feed still did exist, there was just some kind of error giving that message. So I got onto our podcast manager software developer, and he didn't have the foggiest idea what the problem was, so we've basically gone for a workaround. We've simply changed the URL of each of the feeds to an alternative that seems to work, and so far everything seems to be okay. So what I recommend is, if you've already subscribed to the old RSS feeds, what you need to do is simply delete those from your browser and resubscribe by clicking on the updated RSS feed icons on the website. So please do accept my apologies for that, but I think that we're okay now. But of course, if anybody still does have a problem with any of those, please do let me know so that I can look into that a bit further. Just on a programming note, next week we should be speaking to Dr. Paul Craig Roberts on the subject of Syria, and in the week following to Kurt Haskell, who was on the same flight as the so-called underwear bomber on Christmas Day 2009, and whose experience doesn't quite fit with the official explanation of things. And then to Pete Griffiths of Ex-Scientologists UK. But as I said, today's interview is with Dr. Tim Ball, so it's to that we turn now. And Dr. Ball gave a very detailed and extensive interview on the history of the politicisation of climate science. Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, podcasting to you from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. Today is the 18th of June 2013, and it's my great pleasure to be speaking to Dr. Tim Ball, who joins us all the way from the west coast of Canada. Dr. Ball is a retired professor of climatology at the University of Winnipeg, where he taught for 25 years. And in addition to a career of teaching and research, he has also been very active for many years as an environmentalist, an interest which he continues to pursue in his still rather busy so-called retirement, in which he is also a frequent public speaker, consultant, author, and columnist. And Dr. Ball was technical advisor and one of the specialists featured in Martin Durkin's 2007 documentary, The Great Global Warming Swindle. So Dr. Ball, it's great to have you on. Thank you ever so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. Anything to help the people understand what's going on.
Wonderful. Thank you. Now, as you know, in recent weeks, we've been looking into the subject of global warming, specifically the claims by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that the Earth's climate is warming, or at least set to warm, at a potentially dangerous rate, and that we human beings are largely responsible for that due to our industrial production of CO2. And we've spoken with the paleoclimatologist Dr. Eric Karlstrom, Mark Morano of climatedepot.com, and the sea level expert Dr. Neil Saxel-Murner, each of whom is of the opinion that these claims are frankly false. And I know that you, as a climatologist yourself, you've been for many years critical of the IPCC, both on scientific and political grounds. So I'm very, very pleased that you've been able to come on and add your voice to the discussion. Now, before we get on to all of that, could I ask you, first of all, to give us a brief introduction to your background? What was it that sparked your interest in climatology such that you actually became a university lecturer in the subject?
Well, I got interested in it so long ago that global cooling was the consensus or the concern, I should say. But I was born in England. Interestingly enough, my elementary schooling was in the same school that Piers Corbin, who, of course, is becoming quite well known in England for his accurate weather forecasting. So we went to the same elementary school, not quite at the same time. Anyway, that was in Wiltshire. And then I emigrated to Canada when I was 17 because I didn't see a lot of future in England at that time in the 50s. Worked here for a brief while, and then joined the Canadian Air Force. And it was in the Canadian Air Force that my interest in the weather and the climate really started to focus, obviously from the flying perspective, but more important because I was involved in anti-submarine patrols over the North Atlantic and all the way up the East Coast, Baffin Island, Ellesmere, and so on. And then after that, I was in search and rescue in the Canadian Arctic, right to the North Pole. And of course, you simply can't visit that part of the world and not become very deeply, almost religiously hooked by what you see and what the world shows you. It really is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. But because of flying without proper hearing protection, I had a hearing loss. It's a concern I have for all the young people with their Walkman. But anyway, I lost my flying category and I didn't want to fly a desk. They gave me a small cash settlement because I had signed on a fixed contract. And I took that money and went back to a university to finish my education and decided that I would start looking at weather and climate. I did my honors degree in the philosophical considerations of humans as a geomorphic agent, that is changing the surface of the Earth. Then I did my master's degree in a specific study of energy, how energy changes environments. And then I put it all together in a doctoral thesis, which combined this science with historical records of climate, particularly using the Hudson Bay Company records, which is one of the most complete and long-term data sources for environmental change, not just weather. They were using thermometers at Churchill, Manitoba as early as 1768. And of course, the weather was very important to not only their business, but also in terms of their survival in the Canadian wilderness. So I did my doctoral thesis at the University of London, Queen Mary College, and had the great privilege of getting some help and advice from Hubert Lam, who, of course, founded the Climatic Research Unit at the University of East Anglia.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So I had the privilege of him helping me and working with him. I'm sure he's turning in his grave over what's gone on there, but he knew what was coming. But anyway, while I was doing my doctorate, I started lecturing at the university. And then once I got my doctorate, I was on full-time staff there till I retired in 1996. And then since then, I've continued, as you said, to publish and teach and speak.
Mm-hmm. And you publish and teach and speak on a great deal on this subject of anthropogenic global warming and your reasons why you don't agree with it. Could you tell us some of the main scientific reasons why you reject that theory?
Well, one of the things that Hubert Lam set up the Climatic Research Unit for was to gather data. He realized when he was doing forecasting during the war that the forecasts were terrible, and he thought that if he could reconstruct the weather of the past, it would help him predict the weather of the future. And the more he started to look at it, two things occurred to him. One was that there wasn't a lot of data that had been worked on. And the other was that the climate had changed a great deal more in very recent times than people had understood. So that led me into reconstructing a long-term weather patterns. Now, at the time that I started this, as I said, in the 1970s, global cooling was the concern.
I actually remember that when I was at primary school at the time, and I remember the teachers saying that, yes, global cooling is coming. It's going to be a new ice age just around the corner.
Well, exactly. And of course, I was as opposed to that alarmism, if you want, as I have been since the mid-1980s when global warming became the trend and the concern. So it needs to be put into the historic context, and that's what Lam was trying to do. Of course, the CRU got taken over by a group of people that wanted to use the science to show that it was humans that were causing the warming, particularly Tom Wigley. And so I have been a skeptic, as all scientists must be skeptics, because you challenge everything that's out there all the time. If you're not, you're not doing good science. So, as I said, I was as opposed to the cooling predictions and concern and alarmism as I later became about the warming, or as I am now about the warming. But what I saw was, of course, the political takeover of science for an agenda. And that's the part that concerned me.
Yeah. And was it the same kind of reasons, that same kind of scientific reasons that caused you to be skeptical of those original claims, the same kind that you're now skeptical of these claims that are made these days?
Yeah, exactly. Because people don't know the difference between weather and climate. That's a very fundamental difference. And of course, it's lack of knowledge and understanding that's been exploited by these people to push their political agenda. But when you study weather day to day, and if you stand outside, you experience the weather, that's what we call, or scientists call, white noise. It's the sum total of red noise, individual noises. So it's like you're standing outside a soccer stadium with 50,000 people in it. You hear them roaring, but that roar is the white noise of individuals in the stadium. And of course, with trying to understand the weather, you have to pick out what are the important red noises, what are the dominant ones, what are the ones causing change. And I knew right from the start, as Lam had said, we simply didn't have the data, the records, and the understanding to be able to come out and say, as they were doing, with levels of certainty that were completely unjustified. And that's what concerned me. It was true when they were pushing the global cooling, as they have been with the warming. We still don't know enough. And so when you experience that weather standing outside, it's the sum total of everything from cosmic radiation from deep space to heat coming up through the Earth's crust from the volcanic material and everything in between. Now, that's the weather. But if you average the weather over time, that then becomes the climate. So the climate is actually the average of the weather. And of course, I'll just give you an illustration of how they exploited this with the public. When people like myself came along and said, look, you can't even forecast the weather for 5 days, yet you're saying with certainty you know what's going to happen 100 years from now.
I understood that these uncertainties to do with weather forecasting is where chaos theory came from.
Well, the weather is nonlinear. It is chaotic. And we can talk about the history of chaos theory and the cycles and so on, because that's part of this whole story. But their response, when I said, and others said, look, you can't forecast the weather, so how can you be so certain? They said, oh, well, weather is different than climate. Well, no, it isn't. They're different in one sense, but the climate is the average of the weather. If the weather's wrong, the climate's wrong. And of course, that's what they're finding out. Their forecasts, you see the UK Met Office now have got a big conference going on about why are our forecasts so wrong? Not only are their short-term forecasts wrong, but their medium and long-term forecasts are wrong. And the answer is very simply that they're assuming that CO2 is a big driver of the weather and the climate. And it isn't. They're not going to talk about that because, of course, CO2 is still the big boogeyman for the government, for their pay, and for their whole existence. So the charade is continuing, but that's part of what got me interested.
Mm-hmm. But if you go to the NASA website, they seem to be extremely confident. They have all these factors that they point to, which they say it's virtually beyond doubt that if we look at global temperature rise, the warming of the oceans, the shrinking of the ice sheets, the Arctic sea ice is declining, glacial retreat, extreme events, the acidification of the oceans, they look at all these things and say these are all signs that, in fact, there is warming. And as you say, they put this all down to human-produced CO2. Do you take issue with all of those points that they make?
No, what I take issue with is the context in which they present them.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that I used to do in the classroom was I would draw a line on the blackboard with a slope to the line and say, look, this is what the temperature's doing. The world's been warming since 1680, and we're now at 20th century modern warm period. But then I said, well, hang on a minute. And then I would draw a line from one end of that line going downwards and another line at the other end of it going upwards. In other words, extending the period of the record and showing, look, sorry, that's just a brief warming period in a longer cooling period. And of course, the point I was trying to make is that you can argue and show with fact, oh, well, here's warming or here's cooling. It depends upon the starting and ending points of your temperature curve. And this is a game that's been played. So, for example, if you go back even 20,000 years, we were in the middle of an ice age, and the world has warmed up since then. As I mentioned, from 1680 to the present time, the world on average has warmed. Mm. But in there, there's been cooling stretches. We've already talked about the one from 1940 to 1980. So this is a game that they're playing. When you look at the Arctic ice, for example, when you look at the long-term record, of course, I've not only seen it from the air, but I've also studied it for a long time. You can see that there have been very prolonged periods when there's been no Arctic ice in the summertime or Arctic ice at all. But again, it depends upon what period of the record you're looking at. And this is what they're doing. It's like saying we're going to do a study of Julian or a medical exam of Julian and then saying, oh, well, look, to save money, we'll just look at this one wart on his left arm. And then the doctor's report says Julian is a small brown fellow with a tendency to cancer. That's what's happening with climate science today.
That's a very good example. You chose the right arm as well. My impression is that the sun really is the major driving force with regard to the climate. And yet, when I look at the NASA website, they seem to suggest that certainly in the 20th century, that the changes in the climate can't really be put down to the sun at all. And they have a number of statements where they say if the warming were caused by a more active sun, then scientists would expect to see warmer temperatures in all layers of the atmosphere. Instead, they have observed a cooling in the upper atmosphere and a warming in the surface and in the lower parts of the atmosphere. That's because greenhouse gases are trapping heat in the lower atmosphere. They have all these reasons why they're taking the sun out of the equation. Do you think they're right to take the sun out of the equation?
No, they're absolutely wrong. It's just like taking oxygen out of your life. Now, NASA, unfortunately, is one of the agencies that was and still is to some extent exploited in this political agenda of using climate and global warming to blame humans and human production of CO2. Recently, 25 former NASA scientists wrote an article saying that they totally disagreed with what NASA was doing and were opposed to the misuse of NASA for that political agenda. The person primarily responsible for that was James Hansen, who became the head of NASA GIS. Because when we talk about NASA, it's not the total agency, it's the Goddard Institute of Space Studies, which does the climate material for NASA as a space agency. Hansen was handpicked by the political people, Al Gore and Senator Timothy Wirth. They chose Hansen to be the star witness to support their political agenda that humans were causing terrible environmental change, particularly global warming. And the interview with Senator Wirth about how they did this is available on Frontline on PBS, where he said, look, we had this political agenda to be passed by the Congress, but we needed a scientist that would say, yeah, human CO2 and humans are causing the warming. And he said, we heard about this guy at NASA and we contacted him. He agreed to testify. Wirth acknowledges that Hansen is going completely against what his fellow scientists are saying. But of course, he was going to say what the politicians wanted.
Okay, I'll try and find that. I'll try to link to that if I can.
Yes. Now, the interesting part about it is that they weren't just satisfied with getting Hansen to appear before the Senate committee in 1988. They set the stage. And what I mean by that is that they went and looked at the historic record and found out what was the hottest day of the year on average in Washington. That was the day then they scheduled their hearing for. And the night before the hearing, they went in and opened all the windows and shut off the air conditioning.
To create the right impression.
Oh, yeah. So here they're all sitting in this hearing and everybody's sweating because Washington in the summer is unbearably hot and humid. And so here's this guy saying, yeah, global warming is a terrible threat. The whole thing was orchestrated.
I have to say that's almost embarrassingly crass, that move, isn't it?
Oh, it totally is. But Wirth is quite proud of it in the interview. Hansen, of course, then went on to become the director of NASA GIS. He not only controlled the raw data, the temperature data. We have a long list now of all the adjustments he made to all of the records, lowering the historic temperatures to make them look cooler than the modern temperatures, changing the slope of the curve that I talked about. But he also got caught by Steve McIntyre showing that he claimed that 1998 was the hottest year on record, when in fact it was 1934. Hansen claimed he just made a mistake, but in fact it's pretty obvious what he did. Hansen went to England and gave testimony as a bureaucrat at a trial of Greenpeace people who had attacked a coal burning plant in England because he hates coal and he hates coal burning plants. And his whole career has been as an activist, even though he's a bureaucrat.
This is one of the things that Mark Morano pointed out when I interviewed him, that essentially he's an activist, and how strange it is to have somebody who is so passionate in one particular direction in charge of scientific research in that way.
Well, of course, it's the problem, as you know, with civil servants in England and the Whitehall bureaucrats. They're supposed to be completely apolitical. And in fact, one of the questions that I've asked over the years, there is a thing in the U.S. called the Hatch Act, H-A-T-C-H, after the senator that created it. And it sets out the guidelines for political involvement of bureaucrats. How Hansen avoided being charged under that Hatch Act was beyond me until I was at a conference in Washington and spoke with Hansen's former boss, a fellow by the name of James Tone, T-H-O-N-E. Tone had already come out after he retired, came out and said that Hansen was an embarrassment to NASA. I said, well, why didn't you do something about it? How did he avoid the Hatch Act? He said to me, we got the word from very high up not to touch him, to leave him alone. So he had his political friends. And of course, we know who arranged for him to appear before Al Gore's committee. This is just all part of the politicking that was going on that very few people are aware of.
Yes, indeed. You said that there was a lot of manipulation that was going on with respect to the data. And I wanted to ask you about some other claimed manipulation that's been going on. Could I first of all ask you about the hockey stick graph? Because I think that is one of the key images that still remains in people's minds, and Michael Mann's famous graph, which claimed to show a dramatic rise in global atmospheric temperature in the 20th century, hence that hockey stick shape. But I read the book by Andrew Monford, I think brilliantly documents that there were all kinds of methodological problems going on with that research. Could you explain something of what was going on with that graph?
Well, the problem that they had, and this goes back to Hubert Lam again, because his research documented the existence of a warm period from about 900 to 1200 AD. In fact, the Englishman would have liked the summers then.
The so-called medieval warm period.
Medieval warm period, yeah. When you look at the Doomsday Book, for example, they list, I believe it's 36 commercial vineyards as far north as central England.
Right, yes, indeed.
Right, which gives you an idea of how different the climate was.
Much better days.
much better, exactly. And so the medieval warm period, and of course, by the way, because of the good harvests and the surplus food, And the economy that developed from that, that's gave you the ability to build all those Gothic cathedrals.
So warm is not bad.
Oh, warm is good. You better not have cold. Britain's already had a taste of what cold weather does to you, and we're heading for much cooler conditions. But the government's preparing for warming. That's the problem. But to get back to your point about the hockey stick, Lam had produced a graph, and he'd shown it to me when I met with him. And it appeared in the first IPCC report in 1990, and it showed the existence of the medieval warm period and the existence of the Middle Ice Age, the nadir of which was around 1680. And, of course, it was a problem because they were claiming, and by they, I mean the IPCC, led by the people at the Climatic Research Unit, particularly Wigley, Phil Jones, who followed Wigley as director at CRU, and Michael Mann, who was part of that group, Briffa, and all of those people that were involved at the CRU, and the leaked emails, of course, demonstrated what they were doing. They were saying that the 20th century was the warmest it had ever been. And throughout my career, I'd always laughed and phoned radio stations when they came out and said, it's the warmest day ever. And I said, you really mean ever? The world's 5 billion years old. And then they would say, well, it's in the government record. And of course, this was their problem, because people like me and Richard Lindzen and the other so-called skeptics were saying, hang on a minute, it was warmer 1,000 years ago in the medieval warm period, and it was warmer in the Roman period around 0 AD, and it was warmer in the Minoan period in 1500 BC. And so the medieval warm period was contradicting what they were telling the public. And there is a very famous email that was sent to Professor David Deming. Mm. Now, Deming had been looking at the historic record like I had and was challenging what they were saying, but he published an article in 1995 in the journal Science. And it tended to give the impression that he was supporting the idea that human CO2 was causing global warming. In fact, he wasn't. But his article was, of course, a typical academic article in that it was conditional. It wasn't definitive in any way. But as he says in this famous email, he said, obviously, the people, and he's talking about the ones at CRU, thought that he was one of them. That is, people who would pervert science for a social and political agenda. And in the email, it said, we have to get rid of the medieval warm period.
Yes, I heard that before, but that is an astonishing eye-opener, really, isn't it?
Well, it is. And now, the person that is supposed to have sent the email, McIntyre has speculated on this. He, of course, has denied it, has no recollection of it, but Deming has the email, and in fact made this presentation before the U.S. Congress, where he identified what had gone on and what the email said. And it was Jonathan Overpeck, who, of course, has been very, very much in the heart of what's gone on at the Climatic Research Unit. Now, how do you go about getting rid of the medieval warm period? Well, they latched on to dendroclimatology, that is, the use of tree rings to reconstruct past temperatures. The first problem with it is that tree rings don't represent temperature, except in very extreme circumstances. What causes most of a tree growth is precipitation, moisture, and every gardener knows that. But they decided that they were fully representative of temperature, and then they selected certain tree rings to create this graph showing that there was virtually no temperature change from 1400 up to 1900, and then a sudden, very dramatic increase in temperature in the 20th century. That upturn of the temperature in the 20th century, of course, became the blade of the hockey stick. The handle of the hockey stick, almost straight line, was the tree ring data. But they had a problem because even though they handpicked the tree ring data, it all showed a downturn in temperature in the 20th century. And so they had to get rid of that. They had to cover it up. In the emails that were leaked, this is where the phrase hide the decline comes into play. The decline was that the tree rings in the 20th century were showing the temperature going down. So what they did was they programmed the computer to, as the tree ring temperature started to go down, you stopped that and tacked onto it the modern day temperature record.
Is that the trick that was referred to in the emails?
That's referred to as Mike's nature trick. Nature, of course, is the journal in which he published, and that's the trick they're referring to, yes. The hide the decline phrase came from the computer coding. Computer codes are the instructions to the computer of what it has to do. And, of course, when the emails leaked from the Climatic Research Unit, they didn't just leak the emails, they also leaked the computer codes. And it was in those computer codes that this hide the decline phrase showed up. Now, one of the things that has not been stressed is that the blade of the hockey stick, this dramatic upturn in temperatures, was produced by Phil Jones, who was the director of the CRU and also one of the lead authors at the IPCC. Now, Jones's temperature data showed that there had been an increase in temperature of 0.6 degrees Celsius from about 1880 up to the late 1900s. So you had about 100 years of this dramatic temperature increase. He claimed that 0.6 degrees Celsius was more than could occur naturally. That's simply false. When you look at the historic record as I have, there's many, many periods when there's that dramatic an increase. But of course, this provided the blade of the hockey stick that they needed. And this is where the duplicity is amazing, because when they put that into the IPCC report, they put the truth. They said the temperature in his data had gone up 0.6 degrees, but the range of error was plus or minus 0.2 degrees Celsius. So in other words, there was a plus or minus 33% error in his work. Now, that's like saying that a poll, a political poll on an election, is accurate to within plus or minus 33%. You would never, ever use that. But nobody's pointed that out except me, but it's been glossed over.
That's the fine print that nobody looks at.
Exactly. And of course, you see, if, when you look at the IPCC reports, they've done this all the way along. They've said to the public one thing, but what they've written has said something very, very different, so that when their deception is exposed, they can say, oh, well, we acknowledge the data was lousy. We admitted that it was no good.
Right.
But that's not what you said in your summary for policymakers, which was deliberately created to misrepresent what you were doing scientifically. So everything has been done to create one thing scientifically and acknowledge all the limitations, knowing that the public would never read the science reports, the media wouldn't read the science reports, and any scientist like myself that came along and started to raise questions immediately was attacked and said, oh, skeptic, don't listen to them, climate change denier, easily sure. marginalized.
Yeah.
And, you know, the consensus shows and so on. So this was all part of the game, and the hockey stick was part of that. Now, of course, Steve McIntyre, he wasn't studying climate or weather. He saw the graph first at a conference where it was being shown. And because of his knowledge of statistics and graphs, and his expertise was in how you doctor data to produce the results you want, because his expertise was in forensic audit of mining claims. And the minute he saw the graph, he knew what would have been done and how it had been created.
And it's interesting that he's the ideal person to look into that, although I think many people would dismiss him as being, well, he's not a climatologist, so he has nothing to say about it. But I agree with you. It's at that point, it's not looking at climatology per se, it's looking at the statistics.
But, Julian, that speaks to how they got away with what they did. Because you remember when we talked about weather and climate? Well, weather is made up of literally a million pieces.
Yeah.
And in today's world, we've gone from generalization, where people could generalize about things and there was general studies of things, into specialization. And now everybody's a specialist.
Yes, indeed.
But climate, which is the average of the weather, climate is a generalist discipline.
Mm.
In order to understand what the climate's doing, you've got to be able to incorporate into it everything from cosmic radiation in space to geothermal heat off the bottom of the oceans and everything in between. And this is why they talk about climate scientists. Well, people could be a climate scientist. Man claims he's a climate scientist, but that means he's only knowledgeable in one very small, narrow, special area of it. Whereas a climatologist is trying to put all the pieces of the puzzle together, which is what I've been doing. Whenever I've had difficulty, for example, with statistics, I go and get a statistical expert to say, look, is this valid? So when I got involved with another group saying, okay, what's the physics and the chemistry of CO2 as a greenhouse gas? And when the physicists look at what the climate scientists are saying about CO2, they said, you can't do that. You can't say that. So these people have been misusing science, but because it's so wide a subject, nobody's able to pin them down on it.
Yeah, so climate science is, in a way, it's like a large research project into which you are drawing all kinds of resources, with these various resources having their own specialisms, but they all should be working together and cooperating. But in fact, the impression that you're giving me is that that's not really what's going on.
Exactly what's going on.
That the public is being misled into thinking that there are certain people who are, in inverted commas, climate scientists, and they are the people who can say what is what, and yet they might be quite ignorant about certain areas of this broader subject, which are absolutely essential to a proper understanding of the project.
Exactly. The analogy I've used for a long, long time is it's like when you're doing a huge jigsaw puzzle, say with 10,000 pieces. But what you've got is people holding one piece of the puzzle, running around saying, this is the key piece to the puzzle. The truth is, when you do a puzzle, you have to have a method. And the method that most people develop on their own is you find the corner pieces first. Well, in climate science or climatology, we haven't even got the four corner pieces of the puzzle. The four corner pieces would be the atmosphere, the oceans, space, the Earth itself. So we haven't even got the four corner pieces. And then when you start to get the edge pieces to define the parameters of the puzzle, all we can do right now is look at a piece and say, well, that's blue, so I'll put that in the blue pile. It might be atmospheric. It might be ocean, too. I don't know. That's the level we're at with this climatology puzzle. And by the way, all of this applies into society because we've got to the point where now you're not allowed to generalize.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes, indeed.
And what's happened in academia, to generalize is the mark of a fool, to specialize is the mark of intelligence. Well, at some point, you've got to put all those specialized pieces back together again.
Yeah, I noticed that this appeared on your website. I think it was on your front page. You talked about this business about specialism, well, certainly one of the major pages in your website. And immediately I thought this harked back to one of my favorite philosophers, Karl Popper, who years and years ago lamented that this was happening.
Yeah.
And was saying that we're going to get to the point where all these disciplines are not really talking to each other and that knowledge is going to become increasingly fragmented.
Exactly. And it started, by the way, in 1858 when Alexander von Humboldt, the German naturalist, died. He was reputed to be the last universal person. We talk about Renaissance people that have got a wide range of knowledge, but a universal person, von Humboldt knew all of the biology, chemistry, physics that was known at that time. Of course, since that time, the explosion of information has made that impossible. This is part of the reason, of course, why they've been able to deceive the public about the climate and about climatology.
And one of the things that people will point to, and you've made all these points and you've made them very eloquently, but I think you have already brought this up, but I will stress it, that they will point to this business of consensus. And they will say you can make all these good points, so these philosophical points, these scientific points, but nevertheless, there is this consensus and therefore I can't trust what you say because you stand outside of that consensus. And I wanted to ask you what you think about the very notion of consensus within science.
It has no application in science at all. I think Einstein said, I can have 100 facts that prove I'm right. You've only got to get one that proves I'm wrong, and my 100 are meaningless. The consensus is not a scientific fact. And as soon as they started using that word, because I was aware of how the public relations of this whole thing was going down, I knew it was political. It was initially applied using the then 6,000 members of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and of course started pointing out that very few of the people on the IPCC were actually climate scientists. Most of them were bureaucrats. But to have a number and say, well, here's these 6,000 people all being paid and all working on this thing, and they're all agreeing, became a powerful PR tool. One of the classic studies that was done was by Naomi Oreskes, and she came out with an article saying that she had done research of peer-reviewed articles, and there's another term that they pushed, oh, it's got to be peer-reviewed. If it's not peer-reviewed, it's nonsense.
And catch 22.
Well, yeah, well, of course, they controlled the peer-review process, but that's another story.
Sure.
But Naomi Oreskes came out with this article in which she said she looked at, I believe it was 985 articles, something like that, and not one of them disagreed with the consensus. And, of course, she knew nothing about climate science. She was a historian, social scientist, and Gore picked up on that study, and it became a central part of his documentary, The Inconvenient Truth. And it was very quickly shown, but didn't get to the headlines because, of course, the newspapers were presenting very biased information, that the result that she got was determined by the use of keywords. Anybody that uses Google knows that keywords have become paramount to how effective your research is, and it predetermines what results you get. And, of course, she only Googled in a couple of keywords, and that's the result she got. If you Googled in other keywords, you found out that there were thousands of articles that were showing that there wasn't a consensus. And in fact, part of a group that I helped set up called Friends of Science, we commissioned Madhav Khandekar to produce a list of articles that were peer-reviewed and were not part of the consensus. But of course, the media had moved on. They'd established the public view of it, and that was the end of it.
Mm-hmm. There seemed to be something similar going on with that article, which I mentioned to you before the interview, just from looking at the abstract, because they seem to be saying that, they have this figure of 97%, around 97% of people who are writing, you know, in the peer review on the subjects of global warming, that they're in agreement with the official position. But actually, when you look at it more carefully, it does actually seem to be just a subset, that 97% actually only applies to those people who express some kind of opinion at all about global warming. They're in agreement. So those who don't speak about it, to give any opinion about global warming, they're not really included in the conclusion here. And I just think to myself, well, silence doesn't mean that those people are in agreement. It might mean that they're not speaking up because they want to keep their job.
Well, of course, one of the things that you see throughout this whole history of the climate debacle, the great deception, as I call it, is the cherry picking and not necessarily straight lies of commission, but lies of omission. Mm. It's what you leave out that tells the story. They've gone back to the consensus argument because, of course, nature's not playing along with them. Their IPCC projections of what the temperature's supposed to be doing, the public are starting to catch on, the cold weather has given lie to what they've been saying. So they've gone back to those PR things that worked for them in the first place. And of course, the consensus argument was part of this. They commissioned that inquiry that you're talking about. They claimed that they'd interviewed, I think it's in the thousands of people, but actually a very small subset of them were actually related to climate science, and only a very small subset of that subset actually make up the 97% figure that they use.
Yeah.
So as you say, and that's true of virtually any of this. Very little of it bears any rigorous examination. And of course, this is what McIntyre was doing with the hockey stick. And as soon as you start digging into these things, it's very easy to show what was done and how it was done. The problem is getting the media attention and counteracting the use of words like consensus and peer review and global warming skeptic, climate change denier, and all of the campaign of putting down anybody that dared to question what they were doing.
And a climate change denier, has to be said, that's a particularly offensive term, isn't it?
I was first called a climate change denier on the front page of the Times of London several years ago. And there were two things that happened. The word skeptic, of course, they used because they knew for the public, skeptic has a very different meaning than it has for science. If you're not a skeptic, you're not a scientist. You have to be skeptical of everything. And you mentioned Karl Popper earlier and his argument of falsifiability. Mm. That is, you don't try to prove a hypothesis. You skeptically try to disprove it. And of course, what they've done was try to prove it. And therefore, they had to put down anybody that tried to be a skeptic.
Absolutely, yes.
And so to come out and say, well, you're a global warming skeptic. None of us were global warming skeptics, to my knowledge. We all acknowledged that global warming had occurred. As I mentioned earlier in this program, the world's warmed up since 1680. The world's warmed up since 20,000 years ago. What we were skeptical about was their claim that humans were the cause of it. That was the issue. So starting in about 1998, temperatures started to go down. And by 2000, it was becoming apparent that there was a new trend in going on. And they started changing from global warming to climate change. And then the climate change people like myself came out and said, but the climate's always changed. Tell me something I don't know. I know the public don't know how much the climate's changed. So, of course, they were exploiting it again. And they turned around and said, oh, that Tim Ball, he's a climate change denier, with all of the Holocaust connotations of that term. The irony of it is, Julian, that my whole career, as with all of us that have been involved in this, our whole careers have been in educating people to the extent that climate changes all the time naturally. But of course, they didn't want people to know that. They wanted people to think that what's going on now is abnormal, is unnatural. Therefore, it must be caused by humans. And that's underlying the UK Met Office conference that's going on right now.
And you've spent all your working life trying to encourage your students to think critically, haven't you? But this seems to be moving exactly the opposite direction. I mean, many of the things that you've just been saying about the consensus and calling people deniers and the like, all this seems to remind me of the Soviet days. You know, I was thinking of like Lysenkoism and the like, where you have to toe the party line. If you don't, then, you know, you're persona non grata. You know, just it seems incredible that this is going on.
Well, where it's really incredible, of course, is that if you look at traditionally in universities, and that's where so much of the rot is, traditionally what would happen was the old professors had the prevailing wisdoms, and the new young Turks came in and challenged those prevailing wisdoms. When you look at the age of the people that brought about change in science, they were all very young. Einstein, for example, you know, publishing by 1912 when he was 24 or something, and so on. Newton. But what's happened in the 20th century is that that's turned around. And now all of the people that are the so-called skeptics or deniers are the old guard, like myself in my 70s, like Richard Lindzen. And it's the new young Turks coming out of the school system that have been indoctrinated into environmentalism, into climate change. And they come in to the university system, and they are the conservative ones. So they've literally turned upside down the whole natural process of investigation and challenge to the old ways. And it's really a bizarre and frightening situation. Look at what happened in the UK court system when that father, I think Stuart Dimmock was his name, complained to the Department of Education about the showing of Al Gore's movie in the classroom and said, look, this is bias. This is a politically biased thing. My son's being forced to watch it. There's no balance being presented. The court, the Justice Burton, brought down his ruling on Gore's movie and what the Department of Education were doing a week before Gore got his Nobel Prize.
Was it that close?
Oh, it's astonishing. Go and read what Burton's judgment was. It was a brilliant judgment because he said, look, I don't know about the science. All I know is that enough experts have told me there are 9 scientific errors that has not been contradicted. I acknowledge there are 9 scientific errors, but he said, I watched the movie. I'm not an expert in it, but there is no doubt in my mind it is a piece of political propaganda. And that it, if it's going to be shown, it must be shown to the students with that warning told to the students ahead of time. Mm. And we must also show the students some balance. And if you're going to show Gore's movie, you must also show them Durkin's Great Global Warming Swindle and let them make up their own minds. That was what the judge ruled.
He mentioned that particular Durkin movie, did he?
Oh, yes. It's right in his judgment.
And I think it would be very helpful for people to understand the political dimension to this. Because I wanted to ask you about the IPCC, because Niels Axel Mohner, who, as you know, was an expert reviewer for the IPCC until he resigned, is quite clear that the organization is basically political. It masquerades as a scientific institution, but it's essentially political. And I know you agree with that assessment. Could you give us some idea of how the IPCC came into existence and how it actually operates in this way that Niels Axel Mohner is criticizing?
We really have to go back to Malthus, the 19th century church minister who was interested in world population. Overpopulation is a very central theme. And even though you can convince people that humans are not causing global warming, the majority of them think that overpopulation is a problem. And that's another whole story we need to talk about. But Malthus, of course, with his overpopulation, argued that the human population would outgrow the food supply. He was absolutely wrong on that. Obviously, there is an upper limit to the capacity of the planet, but we're not even close. But then in the 1960s, as the whole a new paradigm of environmentalism, which was necessary, by the way, but which has been used and abused by these people in a very damaging ways, the whole idea was picked up by a group called the Club of Rome. Now, the Club of Rome took the Malthusian idea of the population outgrowing food resources to claim that it would outgrow all resources and that it would do this at an accelerating rate because of industrialization. So in other words, the industrialized nations were gobbling up more and more of the world's resources every year, and that there were limits to that growth. And of course, that phrase became the title of a book that they produced called The Limits to Growth. The book was produced by a couple using computer models. It was the first time the computer had been applied to these sorts of issues. And of course, sadly, the use of the computer gave it some sort of credibility that it didn't deserve. People are still enamored of the output of computers, forgetting that it's the old adage that garbage in, garbage out. Somebody recently said with climate models, it's become a gospel in, gospel out.
Yes, indeed.
Which I like. In other words, they program the computer to give the result they want. But anyway, The Limits to Growth came out and had a huge impact on development and industrialization, everything else. At the same time, the population issue was revitalized with a book called The Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich and his wife, Anne Ehrlich. Mm-hmm. And they were arguing that by the year 2000, Britain would be gone. And I mean, just unbelievably how bad their predictions were, yet they've still got credibility. But the Club of Rome brought in several very, very prominent people. Amongst them, and one of the key coordinators of it, was a guy by the name of Maurice Strong. Strong was a Canadian who had gone to the U.S., made a lot of money as an industrialist, started to develop his ideas about the world and how it should be run. Basically, he grew up in a socialist family, and that's fine. No problems with his political ideologies. But he thought that the Club of Rome was really onto something and that we needed to deal with it. In a book called The Cloak of Green, produced by a Canadian investigative journalist by the name of Elaine Dewar, Dewar started out the book wanting to write a book in praise of Canadian environmentalists like Maurice Strong. But the more she did her true investigative journalism, she discovered these people were more corrupt than the people that they were attacking. And so she produced this book, Cloak of Green, in which she identified, and 20% of the book is devoted to an interview with Maurice Strong. And by the way, I've talked to Elaine Dewar, said, you've got to update the book. She said, I wouldn't go near it. I got such nasty attacks, the worst in my life. I wouldn't go anywhere near it. But anyway, in that book, Strong makes the comment that the problem for the planet are the industrialized nations, and isn't it our responsibility to get rid of them? And he does it in the way that these people work all the time. He's speculating, but it's a bit like that old joke about many a true word said in jest. Well, many a true speculation, you know, is put into practice.
And what you say is echoed there with another reporter who was speaking from, it was West Magazine, where Strong was talking about writing a novel. And in this novel, he was saying, he was speculating, as you say, that part of the plan of the novel would be to ask the question, oh, isn't it our responsibility to get rid of the industrialized nations, or something to that extent. So this is another source which has the same thought in it.
But the thing you've got to ask yourself is, and this is what's amazing about these people, it's one thing having an idea. It's another thing doing something about it. Mm. This is the genius. I happen to think it's an evil genius, but this is the genius of Maurice Strong. Because when Dewar said to him, and this is all in her book, that's a very interesting idea, so why don't you run for politics and implement your idea? Strong said, you can't do anything as a politician, which is one of the most frightening and cynical comments of the 20th century, as far as I'm concerned. Now, it's echoed by that Lord Conrad Black, who the British are very familiar with. Because in an interview, Black was asked, why don't you run for politics? And his response was, I don't need to. And there's a degree of cynicism in that that's frightening. But anyway, ask yourself how you would set about shutting down industrialized nations. If you think about a nation like a car, they're running on fossil fuels. You can stop the engine to the car by cutting off the fuel line into the car. But if you did that with a nation, there would be immediate reaction. Mm. But if you could show that the byproduct of burning that fossil fuel was destroying the climate, causing global warming, then you could shut down the industrialized nations. Because now you're saving the planet. Now you're getting rid of this evil pollution, even though CO2 isn't a pollutant, but later they set about making it a pollutant. And so Elaine Dewar said to Maurice Strong, well, how are you going to do this? If you don't want to run for politics, how are you going to implement this idea? And he said, I'm going to go to the United Nations where I can get all the money I want and not be accountable to anybody. And he then got onto the United Nations because of his connections with the Prime Minister of Canada at that time and other people, Paul Martin Jr. Now, he'd given Paul Martin Jr. a job when he was a young man. So Martin was grateful to him. But he got onto the United Nations and set up the United Nations Environment Program, which, of course, created the Agenda 21, which is now becoming a concern to a lot of people about one world government and total government control. And out of the United Nations, or out of the UNEP program, United Nations Environment Program, came the Rio Conference of 1992. Out of the UNEP program came the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was a subset of the United Nations Commission on Climate Change. So the Rio Conference and UNEP organized the political side of environmental control and climate change. And the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was set up to create the science that they needed to demonize CO2. And what's interesting is in that same year of 1992, Maurice Strong took another job as the chairman of Ontario Hydro. Now, in Canada, utility companies that produce power are called hydro because hydroelectric power is the predominant form of power in Canada. And he became chairman of Ontario Hydro and set about making it green. He set a plan to get rid of the nuclear power plants. He set out a plan to get rid of the coal-burning plants. He set up a plan to bring in the wind turbines. Ontario now, 20 years later, is in serious, serious energy problems. It's a classic example of what happens when you try to go green and implement what Strong wanted done with the IPCC.
Can I just throw one thing in here which solidifies what you've been saying? Because you pointed to the Club of Rome and how these ideas were there, first of all, prior to the setting up of the IPCC. And there was that 1991 publication just before the Rio summit, the first global revolution, has this, I think, real telltale quote in it. I'll just, if I may, just give the quote. In searching for a new enemy to unite us, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. All these dangers are caused by human intervention, and it is only through changed attitudes and behavior that they can be overcome. The real enemy, then, is humanity itself. So that agenda was very much there, even before this was set up.
Oh, exactly. It didn't come out of nowhere. And of course, one of Maurice Strong's geniuses was his organizational ability, his ability to talk people into virtually anything. And, of course, one of the things that came out of the Rio conference and the UNFCCC was the definition of climate change. For the IPCC, and very few people know this, the definition of climate change says you only look at those climate changes caused by human activity. Now, the problem with that is, and, of course, we go back to what Lam and I had been talking about, unless you know how much climate changes and what the causes of those natural changes are, you can't possibly separate out the human portion of it. But they didn't want to know what was going on naturally. They wanted to be able to show only those things that humans were doing and then therefore prove their hypothesis.
Indeed, as it said in that quote, all these dangers are caused by human intervention. There it is.
Yep. So this is how Strong set up the IPCC. So now through the UNEP program, Agenda 21, he's got the political control. And of course, that's where the NGOs and all of those came in. And through the IPCC, he's now got control of the science. And their job is to show that CO2 is causing global warming. And they set about that ruthlessly. Now, they did it by organizing, first of all, three reports. There's Working Group 1, Working Group 2, and Working Group 3. And groups of people were assigned to produce these three reports. Working Group 1 is the physical science basis. The number of actual climate people working on that is very minimal. Most of these people are bureaucrats. The people at the Climatic Research Unit controlled critical chapters of the IPCC reports. So within the Working Group One Physical Basis, for example, they controlled the chapter on data, our friend Phil Jones, the director of CRU. The paleoclimate, that is reconstruction of past climates, latterly was controlled by Michael Mann. And in fact, one of the things that's been pointed out was that Mann didn't have his doctoral thesis. It was rejected by his first committee. He went to another university, got his thesis approved, and within months was appointed as a lead author of the IPCC.
Wow. It must be a genius.
Well, I can't get involved in that. All I want people to know is they sought out James Hansen because he would tell them what they wanted to hear. They needed something that would show that the medieval warm period didn't exist. Anyway, so the control of the chapter on computer models. These are critical chapters. The data, the historic reconstruction, and the computer models. Those are the critical chapters. See, this is where, again, strong and the evil genius comes in, because in the science reports, if you read the physical science report, Working Group 1, they tell you all the limitations of what they're doing. You read Chapter 8, and it says, hey, the computer models, we don't know. We haven't got any data. The models don't work. The results are useless. But then what happens is the results of Working Group 1 are taken, saying, oh, yeah, CO2 is causing warming. Working Group 2 then start with that assumption, and they say, okay, what's the impact of this? And so Working Group 2 gets all these speculations about, oh, warming's going to cause this, and warming's going to cause that. Well, that's the stuff that goes out to the media. Oh, we've got warming, and you know, all the frogs are going to die, and all of, you know, I mean, the Arctic ice is going to melt, the rainforests are going to disappear, on and on and on and on. All based upon the assumption that's been artificially created in Working Group 1. Working Group 3 then takes the impacts and says, oh, there's going to be all these impacts, and here's the government policies you've got to introduce to stop that happening. Well, you're going to have a carbon tax, and you've got to shut down industry. So the whole thing is so incestuous within itself. But not satisfied with that, they knew, Strong knew, that nobody, no media especially, were going to go and read the science report. So they created the Summary for Policymakers. And the Summary for Policymakers is made up of a different group of politicians and bureaucrats who are given information by the lead authors of the chapter of the Working Group 1. So, for example, in the 2001 report, which included the hockey stick, the lead author of that chapter, Mann, was also the author of the primary information in that chapter, his own hockey stick graph, who then made sure that the hockey stick graph was in the Summary for Policymakers. So again, there was incestuousness within that. Phil Jones, of course, with his 0.6 degree. Those were the two things that came out of the 2001 report that the media said, well, here's this hockey stick graph and here's this 0.6 degree temperature increase. Absolute proof of human cause of global warming. Okay, that was all orchestrated. The Summary for Policymakers is orchestrated. The Summary for Policymakers is released by the rules, the terms of reference that Strong set down is released before the science report is released. And it's done through a public relations blitz. And it's done months before the actual science report's released. Because the summary goes back to the science report people, basically says, make sure your science report agrees with what we've already told the public in the summary.
Extraordinary.
It's like an executive writing a summary of an examination of the business, then telling the employees to come up with the facts to support the summary. It is that perverse. That's what they've set up. That's how it's done. And that's what's been going on. And of course, some people that were co-opted to the IPCC, you mentioned Mortimer with his sea level stuff. He resigned. Chris Lancey resigned because of his expertise in hurricanes. And they were challenging him and trying to put in things that he said were wrong. Richard Lindzen, he finally gave up on it and quit. So there's been all of these resignations from the IPCC.
So they achieve a sense, an impression of consensus there just by people being eliminated, essentially.
Oh, yes. Yes. And of course, you then marginalize those people that have quit. It's a standard thing that you can isolate those people that are causing you trouble very easily. And it's why we've got to protect people that are willing to put their heads on the line and on the chopping block. And you go and look at what Lindzen went through. And it was only because he was a very senior professor at MIT But even then, funding was cut off. Now, the other thing that Maurice Strong did was, again, part of his genius at organizing bureaucracies. He set up the IPCC through the United Nations Environment Program, but in conjunction with the World Meteorological Office. Now, the WMO, based in Geneva, is made up of the national weather agencies from every country in the world. They represent the WMO. And by making them the main controllers of the IPCC, so, for example, the UK Met Office is a member of WMO. It then appoints, as the member of WMO, it appoints who is to serve on the IPCC. And so by involving those national weather agencies, they had control. It kept political control in each country in the world. Because if a politician is going to say, well, hang on, UK Met Office, I don't like what you're saying here. I disagree. They turn around, well, we're the experts. We're your civil servants. Why do you have us? Why are you bothering us? What do you know about this? You could marginalize any politician that would dare to challenge what was going on. And of course, that's precisely what happened. But this is all part of the strategy. Now, the other thing that happened, research funding from government agencies funding the research. And of course, all of the research funding was directed to just one side of the science. And of course, we've said that if you create a hypothesis, you try to disprove it. And all of the research was directed to proving it. Joanne Nova out of Australia has done a study on, I think it's $70 billion in the US directed to this funding. And of course, that is attractive to a lot of scientists. It's research funding and money coming. And one of the things that I've watched, and this is part of the problem as well, Julian, is using the right keywords. Because we talked about keywords with publications and Google searches. It's also true about applications for research grants. I sat on committees. I watched people, got to see the certain keywords in there that trigger the funding. Funding has become an essential part of an academic's career. It used to be publish or perish. Now it's publish or perish or bring funding. And the more funding you bring in, of course, the higher status you have within the university. And this has been part of the issue that's been raised with Penn State and British universities. Certainly, when you look at the money going into the climatic research unit and the University of East Anglia benefiting from that. And of course, I think that's been one of the most outrageous things is the cover-ups that have gone on at these various universities of what was clearly a problem. So the funding became very much a part of it.
I think it's very important to point out that because going back to one of the things we were talking about earlier, you mentioned about conspiracy theories, which you'd actually talked about before the interview itself. A lot of people would look at this and they would say, well, it can't possibly be as you describe it because this would involve so many people across the globe in a single conspiracy. Therefore, we can't consider this at all. But if you bring in other factors, such as you're suggesting here, the pressure that's put upon people by funding and all sorts of other political factors, economic factors, groupthink, and all these other factors that are included, then it can help to explain how there could be quite a small group of people who are actually driving this, and all these other factors are in play, making it a phenomenon on a global scale.
Oh, absolutely. But back of all of this, though, Julian, is the old comment that no one person can change the world. And so many of these adages are simply not true. Single people have changed the world. The problem is, the most part is for the bad. You've only got to mention Mao Zedong, Hitler, and throughout history, people that have changed the world. Very few have done it for the positive. You could argue that Christianity and Jesus is a positive. But in the public's mind, no one person can change things. But as I said, it's simply not true. They then extend that into, well, no small group of people could change it, that they would be caught out, they would be seen, somebody would challenge them. And the proper phrase for these groups of people that want to bring about social, political, or economic change, cabal, C-A-B-A-L. This is a group of like-minded people with a singular objective. And of course, that's what happened with the climate issue. That Maurice Strong drew around him politicians and people with power were like-minded. And then in the IPCC, they only brought in and appointed people through the WMO and through the Climatic Research Unit, people that were on board. It is possible for a small group of people to take control. And of course, the mechanisms that were at work here were lack of understanding of science, the fear of the sky falling, the Chicken Little syndrome, the desire to do right by the planet, environmentalism. And here comes James Lovelock, produces Gaia, Mother Earth, the princess, because Lovelock has now changed his mind once he realized what was going on. So it was all very, very cleverly orchestrated. And of course, Maurice Strong, as I said, and I talked to people that grew up with him, that went to school with him, that worked for him, were in business with him, and they all say that he was a genius at organizing and manipulating and controlling. Just to give you an illustration, I've given presentations where Environment Canada employees have come up and said, we agree with you, but we daren't say that publicly.
Have they really?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure there are people at the UK Met Office that have had disagreements.
Mm-hmm.
And look what happened there. The leaked emails where they had Harabin and they had Richard Black. And they had their contact people that said, hey, these guys in your organization are causing trouble. Shut them up.
This is Richard Black, the BBC environmental correspondent, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. George Monbiot was another one. And you see the leaked emails. These people are being fed the data. Andrew Revkin at the New York Times, within a month of the leaked emails coming out, he resigned because his emails are in there saying, what do I say about this? Well, what's that got to do with journalism?
Yeah, but it's amazing how a lot of this was glossed over by the mainstream media, wasn't it? Where people were saying, oh, well, all these emails have been misunderstood. Didn't understand the context. If we really understood the context, we'd know that it was all quite mediocre. Nothing to look at here, really.
Right. And that's the old thing about, you know, like the British Bobby, you know, nothing to see here. Move on. But the person who leaked the emails, out of 220,000 emails, leaked 1,000 initially. How would you pick out 1,000 if you weren't totally familiar with the 220,000 and which ones were significant? What they did was they said, look, here is venality. Here are things that the public can say, hey, you can't do that. You can't get editors fired. You can't control the BBC. They wanted the public to understand that what was going on here was verging on criminality, that the science issue, we'll get to that later. And in the second 5,000 emails they leaked a year later, then there was much more about what they'd done about the science. So the person who leaked those emails knew precisely what was going on and how to get to the public.
It was very clearly presented there was a hack from outside, wasn't it?
Yeah, you see, again, that was a cover-up. Because Jones, as soon as he knew that the information had been taken out, what did he do? He called the police, told them that there'd been a burglary. If the information was obtained by hacking, then it got very limited use in a UK court. If the information is given out by a whistleblower, it can be used in a court. But Jones painted himself into a corner because by telling the police the stuff had been stolen, when the police said, well, are these your emails? He had to say, yes, they are. So he got himself in a corner. And then what did the police do? The Norfolk police brought in a special unit and they called in Scotland Yard, delayed it so long that the statute of limitations ran out. How did that happen? Why did that happen? Okay, and then they come out and say, oh, no, it's all over. But one thing we can say for certain is that it wasn't an inside job.
So do you think that they've lost the game? Do you think by all this people, you know, the genie's out of the bottle and there's no way of putting it back in now?
Yes and no. The people that created this won't be held accountable. Nobody's going to go to jail. Nobody's going to lose their jobs over this. And yet I think it's criminality on a global scale. I mean, when you think about the fact that the CO2 issue caused biofuels to be created, caused the price of corn to go through the roof, which caused starvation in the world, it's documented how many people starved to death because of the increase of food prices due to that. There's criminality on a global scale here, in my opinion. So people will never be held accountable for that. They'll just walk away. The problem is, business has now caught on to it. business sees an opportunity. So you pick up a car ad. What does it say? Oh, the CO2 output of this car is, it's irrelevant. In fact, the more CO2 the car puts out, the more the trees are going to grow.
Indeed. And this was the essence of the announcement in Davos earlier this year, wasn't it? That these trillions of dollars, it was advised that they should be spent by governments in order to encourage green businesses. Once that gravy train is really going, how on earth can you stop it?
Well, exactly. And of course, the other gravy train for the politician, and they're talking about this now, carbon tax.
Yeah.
It isn't carbon they're talking about. It's CO2. CO2 is a gas. Carbon's a solid. They're completely different things.
Do you think they say that because in people's minds it's black and it's nasty? And
it's soot. Carbon is soot. Absolutely. It's part of the argument that it's a pollutant or a harmful substance that the Environmental Protection Agency named it. But again, look at the damage. Look at what's happening in the UK, the wind farms, the alternative energies that were sold and produced green jobs. I was looking at a study in the US where they estimated that the green jobs created cost $11 million for each green job. It's absolutely incredible. Again, we were trying to say solar power is not constant. You have to have backup. Wind power is not constant. You have to have backup. Wind power kills birds by the millions. But the problem is, and the reason I was talking about Al Gore's movie is, and we tried to do this with Durkin's film, but you see, the minute you try to get the science correct, you lose the public. But what happened with Durkin's movie? Martin produced the movie, and then he withheld the release of the DVDs, which he paid for out of his own money, by the way. He withheld the release of them because one of the graphs, only one graph, was improperly labeled. And he wouldn't release the DVDs until it was corrected. Al Gore's movie is out there with 9 legally identified scientific errors. It's never been corrected, never adjusted, is still being shown in the schools. This is the distortion and the challenge if you're going to counteract this with a movie that explains to people what's actually happening.
So what we really need is another movie like Durkin's, more modernized. But where is the money going to come from to fund such a thing?
Well, of course, that's the problem. Nobody is going to fund it.
Not even big oil, because you are accused, aren't you, of receiving backhanders from the oil industry all the time. I presume that's not true.
Totally not true. I'm still waiting for the check. In fact, Julian, I have become trying hard not to become so cynical that I wish I had taken the other route. And I understood the science. I could have played the game. I could have made a lot of money. I mean, look at Al Gore. You know, he's going to be a green billionaire. By the way, he's got out of that industry completely now. You look at his stock portfolio, it's got nothing to do with the environment or saving the planet or anything else anymore.
Still, it has to be said that history is on your side, though, isn't it? Because, you know, one day it will be known that you were on the white side of things rather than the black side of things.
I'm reminded of how I thought when they announced that they were, after 394 years, forgiving Galileo. I'm sure he was thrilled.
Yes, good point. Well, Dr. Bohr, it's been a delight to speak to you, and it feels like we could really go on talking forever. You have so much information there in your mind that you've collected over the years with all your experience. I'm very, very pleased that you've been able to come on, and I do hope that you'll be able to speak to us again at some point in the future.
Great, Julian. Thanks. Getting late over there.
It is indeed. I need to go and have my tea.
Okay.
Malthus was wrong. I have some food to eat.
Yeah. Okay. Bye-bye.
Wonderful to speak to you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.